This podcast is brought to you by Minimal Productions. Producer Jim Minns.
Bail is refused.
You're out of order!
If it pleases the court.
To adopt this affirmation, please say the words, I do.
I do.
Nothing further from this witness.
Given the serious nature of this offence,
this case is dismissed.
In this episode, the Whigs sat down with Jeffrey Robertson QC to talk about international law in the context of a war over Nagorno-Karabakh. Jeffrey Robertson QC is a human rights barrister, academic, author and broadcaster. He holds dual Australian and British citizenships. He's a founder and joint head of Doty Street Chambers in London and serves as a Master of the Bench at the Middle Temple, a recorder and visiting professor at Queen Mary University of London. Robertson has been counsel in many landmark cases in constitutional, criminal and media law in the courts of Britain and the Commonwealth, and he makes frequent appearances in the Privy Council and the European Court of Human Rights. He's published many works on international law and freedoms, including most relevantly for this discussion, his book in 2014, The Inconvenient Genocide, Who Now Remembers the Armenians? Nagorno-Karabakh, a small self-governing democracy of 170,000 Armenians, is settled in a mountainous enclave between their fellow Armenians and Azerbaijan. In the early 1990s, a war between the Azeris and inhabitants of Nagorno-Karabakh, or Artsakh as it's known locally, resulted in 30,000 deaths and a line of control around the border, over which the rival armies have faced off but not fully engaged until a week or two ago when the war kicked off again. Last week, Mr. Robertson published an opinion in the Australian newspaper about the war, and the Whigs invited him on to discuss that further with a focus on international law. Nagorno-Karabakh raises a complex area of international law. When can territory that is technically part of an existing state secede and declare independence or perhaps join another state? Known as the right of self-determination or remedial secession, it is a right or principle that many states have long been hostile to, but which is slowly moving into the mainstream of international law. What follows is a discussion that we hope you find fascinating, if a little disturbing, and undoubtedly important.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Whigs, a special edition of The Whigs. We're a wig down tonight, unfortunately, with Felicity Graham up in the air, flying across the great state of New South Wales. But in her place, we have, well, of course, Emmanuel Kirkasharian.
Hi, Jim.
How are you, sir? And in Felicity's place, we have Jeffrey Robertson, QC. How are you, sir?
I'm fine, as well as could be in lockdown in London.
And can we introduce our special guest tonight, the Deputy Mayor of Dubbo, Mr. Stephen Lawrence.
Well played, Jim. Rewind the tape and start again with our real special guest.
Mr. Jeffrey Robertson, thank you so much for being here with us on The Whigs. We know you're in lockdown. We know that you're going through, the busy schedule that you have.
And I can't get back to my native land. Your government won't let me in.
It's a crying shame.
Right under Magna Carta to return to my native land has been severely threatened.
Absolutely. Now, without further ado, we're going to kick off the discussion tonight. The ball is in Emmanuel Kirkasharian's court to take it away with our first line of questions. Mr. Emmanuel Kirkasharian, take it away.
Yeah, so thanks for coming on, Jeffrey. And the reason, I think one of the reasons I reached out to you and asked you if you'd come on is because I read an article that you did in The Australian about what's happening in Nagorno-Karabakh, in Artsakh right now, which is, of course, very dear to me. And I just wondered if you'd start by giving a bit of background about that and we'd sort of take it from there.
Sure. Well, I wrote the article because I'm one of the few Australians to have ventured into this beautiful little country. Country in the clouds, I call it, because it's got lots of high mountains that are capped with clouds, beneath which are thousands of amazing early Christian churches. Armenia was the first country to convert back in 300 AD, and you can find churches almost as old as that in Nagorno-Karabakh, or Artsakh, as it was historically known, a place for highland Armenians throughout its history. And that history is the reason why it's being bombed and strafed. It's 170,000 people who have their own little democracy. I've been there to actually undertake a study of how democratic they are. And I met all their judges, I met their 45 lawyers they have for 170,000 people. And I looked at their politics and their elections and so forth. And it is truly an independent democracy, although, of course, they are Armenians ethnically, but they rely increasingly, unfortunately, on the Armenian army. They could be a province. They're a bit like, they are, as to Armenia, I guess, pretty much as Scotland is to England. They're islanders. They have their own remarkable history. You go back, this little country was a hub of intellectual and cultural development over the centuries. It was taken by Russia in about 1805, I think, if memory serves, and it's been undergone a census every so often, which has proved that 90% of the people in this area, which is, as I say, a mountainous area, which is flanked by Azerbaijan on one side, by Turkey on another, and of course with a little road that is a lifeline for them to Armenia, which has enabled them to survive. But the story of Artsakh really begins in 1921, when you have Lenin and Stalin setting up the USSR, the Soviet republics that they would, and they had a Republic of Armenia and a Republic of Azerbaijan. And Nagorno-Karabakh, for every reason, ethnically and historically, belonged as part of Armenia. But the story is that Ataturk, who of course had the Turkish suspicion of Armenians, persuaded them to give Nagorno-Karabakh to Azerbaijan. But they gave it as what is termed an oblast, i.e. an autonomous republic within Greater Azerbaijan. So from the outset, it had that degree of independence, although technically, as a matter of international law, Stalin gave it in 1923 under the status of an oblast, of an autonomous area. He gave it to Azerbaijan. And so later on, the Azeris, we'll call them, as everyone does for shortness, the Azeris did a bit of transmigration. They put a lot of Azeris into Nagorno-Karabakh. And of course, there were quite a few Armenians still in Greater Azerbaijan. But they never, never sunk below about 75% Armenian in Nagorno-Karabakh. And it came to a crunch after the Soviet Union dissolved in 1988, I guess, to 1990. And then the racial hatreds that had been we all remember the Armenian genocide when 1.5 million Armenians were slaughtered in the 1915 by the Turkish Ottomans with obvious sympathy from their Muslim friends in Azerbaijan. And those ancient hostilities broke out as the Soviet Union broke down. There were pogroms. Armenians were slaughtered in Baku, the capital of Azerbaijan, in Sumgait, and there broke out a war in which both sides, I have to say, committed some war crimes. But it was a time when the people of Nagorno-Karabakh voted. First of all, they voted for unification with Armenia. And then, because they won the war, there was an extraordinary development, because the Karabakh army, which had been was formed in 1988, and it worked miraculously to protect Stepanakert, the capital of Nagorno-Karabakh, which was low-lying, and there was an Azeri stronghold above it in a place called Sushi. And I think one of the great war crimes of recent times was the bombing and shelling of Stepanakert, as the Azeris aimed their guns and their bombs at schools and hospitals in Stepanakert. It was terrible. I interviewed a lot of survivors. I went to Nagorno-Karabakh. I'm probably one of the few Australians who knows the place, to produce a report on it. It was a report for the, or backed by the Armenian government, so let's declare that. But I was independent, and I was looking at how independent the parliament and the courts and lawyers were. And I decided, after a few visits, that they were, in fact, independent. So it really was, when it declared its independence in 1992, after the Karabakh army, with some Armenian support, had sneaked up. It was a brilliant, one of the great maneuvers of military history, as they sneaked up with an old Russian tank and took the city that was bombarding Stepanakert. And they won that war. And in 1994, there was a peace settlement which allowed them to remain in Nagorno-Karabakh. They had quite a few buffer places, provinces that they had taken from the Azeris, and they are, of course, have a lot of Azeri people. And one solution that we might come to is returning some of those provinces. But Nagorno-Karabakh itself is this wonderful, independent, de facto republic, which, in my view, as an international lawyer, has attained a right, like Kosovo, like East Timor, to what is called remedial succession, secession, rather. And it's nothing succeeds like secession, but it's not usually favored in international law unless there is an element of persecution. And that was certainly suffered by the Armenians in Nagorno-Karabakh during the war that was fought in 1988. They're entitled, historically, legally, and every other way, in my view, to be the same as Kosovo and East Timor. But the current situation is really deplorable and dangerous. Hundreds of people on both sides are dying, because the Azerbaijan has suddenly decided in the last few months that it will recapture Nagorno-Karabakh. It will recapture it by war, and it has declared a war of aggression against Nagorno-Karabakh. It intends to attack, to occupy the country. It will kill civilians, it is at the moment, and it will reclaim the territory and input, I guess, a few hundred thousand Azeris in place of the proud Karabakhs who won their right of independence and voted for it almost unanimously in a referendum in 1992. So that is the position, where it is very worrying that here on the edge of Europe, both countries are members of the European coalition that is called the, not the European Union, which is a very much closer coalition of 27 states, but the wider 49-state Council of Europe, and here they are killing each other, and here they are, in my view, committing the crime of aggression, which has newly been added to the arsenal of the International Criminal Court. But of course, it takes the Security Council to refer the matter to the International Criminal Court prosecutor, and there is no sign of that, because you have Turkey making warlike noises, its loathing of Armenians shown by the fact that it still denies the 1915 genocide. And you have Azerbaijan, of course, determined to go in and slaughter, if need be, the people of Nagorno-Karabakh. And you have Russia, which I think is playing a very dirty and devious game, because Russia was responsible for this. And Russia has an agreement, a self-defense agreement with Armenia. And whenever I've spoken to Armenian politicians, I say, for heaven's sake, get rid of Russia. You can't trust it. Build up an agreement with the European Union. NATO is your only real protection. But of course, they went along with Russia, which has a military base in Armenia, which it isn't using. It's washed its hands of Nagorno-Karabakh. It says it's not part of Armenia in international law. And it won't put any pressure on Azerbaijan for two reasons. Firstly, Putin's oligarchs are in bed with Azeri oil and gas, and that's the great trump card that Azerbaijan has. And secondly, because it's just not prepared to recognize that it is really responsible for this mess.
You mentioned NATO. Turkey is a part of NATO, I think. Is that
That's right.
Does that pose a problem in the sense that the Turks are, I think, in part at least, it seems, behind this aggression?
Well, Turkey, as the one Muslim member of NATO and of the alignment with Europe, is enormously important. That is why Britain and America cannot bring themselves to acknowledge the genocide, because Turkey gets neuralgic and takes reprisals whenever any country acknowledges it. When the New South Wales Parliament did some years ago, they banned all MPs from going to Gallipoli. That's the kind of rather puerile retribution it takes, and so no one dares. I called my book about on the subject The Inconvenient Genocide, because speaking out about it does incur Turkish wrath. And it's, of course, genocide denial is rather a continuation of the idea, if you can't face up to the fact that Turkish people were massively killing Armenians in 1915, it allows the thought that Turkish people are still keen to have them killed in 2020, and Turkey has been assisting. It's denied it, but then people have come forth to admit that they've been paid, they are Syrians who've been paid by Turkish companies to join the Azeri forces to bolster their war, in effect, their war against Armenia. So Turkey is certainly a problem, and Erdogan's comments have put fire on the bonfire, and are very unattractive.
Jeffrey, you said that it requires the Security Council to refer it, and that seems unlikely. But if magically somehow there was a referral, it does really seem like there's the conduct of the Azeris at least amounts to criminal conduct in international law. Would that be right?
That's right. It is the crime of aggression, attacking another territory, taking the initiative, which they did on the 27th of October, to go in to, as they saw it, reclaim the territory. There was a long lead up where the Azeri president has been beating the drum and offering in, promising some form of invasion. And I think it came when Armenia was crippled with coronavirus. It was one of the areas most heavily hit, as was Iran, which is just below and actually has a border with Armenia. So it's it was a time when the Azeris felt it was ripe to strike. There was obviously an agreement with Turkey, and it amounts, in my view, to the crime of aggression, even though Armenia, of course, says, well, we're not invading a country. We are taking back this independent de facto republic of Nagorno-Karabakh, which is ours, but it's never been theirs, historically, culturally, or in any other way, other than Stalin's decision, which made it this autonomous area of Azerbaijan. But that is a historical, it was said to have been at the urging of Ataturk, but there it is. It's a historical anomaly. And for 25 years, the highland people of Armenia have made it their own. And it should, I suppose, technically become a province of Armenia. But for the time being, it's been an independent republic and entitled, in my view, as a matter of international law, to this right of remedial secession.
There's a lot of fear amongst Armenians that I know that there will be an attempt, if they were to succeed, to then effectively engage in some sort of ethnic cleansing or removing the Armenian population there.
Well, that will certainly happen. That is happening. Yeah. And a lot of Karabakh people have hit the road for Armenia because they'll be safer there at the moment. It's, you know, the war crime is that's being committed as we speak is the use in particular of Israeli drones. It's sad that Israel, which of course Jewish people suffered the genocide perpetrated by the Germans, who had previously been advisors to the Ottoman Turks over the genocide of the Armenians. The two peoples have a lot in common, and it's sad to see Israel supplying so many drones, armed drones, that are flown by the Azeris, as the Israelis knew, over the people of Stepanakert and hitting their schools and hospitals and homes. And that's just one of the sad complications and ironies of this war. Another is, of course, Russia's behavior, because it has been making a fortune selling arms to Azerbaijan, and then it sells the same arms to Armenia, but at a cheaper rate because of the so-called alliance. So I hope, one of the things I hope for at the end is that Armenia will see the sense and kick the Russians out, close their base in Armenia, because they don't deserve it.
Is your mattress making noises it never used to? Or is it sagging, causing you to... Then it's time to get a new one. Get the best sleep at the best value with a Nectar mattress. Prices start at just $499, and you get $399 in accessories thrown in, a 365-night home trial, and a forever warranty. Go to nectarsleep.com.
There's no way of tracing back, is there, in sort of international criminal law, to the people who supply the arms for the crimes that are committed with them, is there?
Not at the moment, although complicity in a war crime seems to me to be. I mean, we've just pulled out after 27 years in hiding the guy who from Paris, who was the funder of the genocide in Rwanda. The owner of Radio Mill Colleens, which broadcast the grave is only half full, who will help us fill it? Mm. And incitement to barbaric conduct in Rwanda. And that was back in 1995. And he's eventually been fished out of Paris and will now go on trial. So complicity is a matter of great interest at the moment in, as a matter of international criminal law, but it's difficult to develop that at a time when the Security Council is poleaxed between America and Russia. It's not impossible in this case if Russia were to live up to its responsibilities as the cause of these problems historically, that it might agree not to veto a motion. And of course, America, we wait to see what's happening there, but it does have a very strong Armenian diaspora, particularly in California. So they may support a reference, but the problem is Turkey, a co-conspirator, and Turkey has a lot of generates a lot of fear about crossing Turkey because it's got it's important as a link between West and East.
Mm. What's the position? Oh, sorry, Dustin, go.
I was going to ask Jeffrey, what's the international community position generally been on the Azerbaijani claim to be sovereign over the territory?
Oh, well, that was accepted by the General Assembly of the United Nations back in 1994, where they were trying to reach peace settlement, and they accepted the claim, that, which was historic, was true. I mean, in 1921, Lenin, at the urging of Ataturk, and in 1923, Stalin enshrined in law that Nagorno-Karabakh, although 94% at the time Armenian, would be allocated to Azerbaijan rather than Armenia, the two new Soviet republics, but would be an autonomous area, an oblast with a lot of independence. That was the idea, of course, and it broke apart when the Soviet Union broke apart in 1988. But the international law position has never been tested.
Mm.
There's never been a case because for the last 25 years, obviously, Armenia, rather the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh, have made themselves into a democratic republic. And I don't think there's any question about that. But whether they have attained the right of remedial secession that's been accorded to Kosovo and East Timor and other, the former Yugoslavian states, remains to be tested.
We're sort of limited.
So is the General Assembly position... Sorry, Manny, you go.
Oh, no, Justin, sorry.
Yeah, I was just going to say, so is the General Assembly position or the position of all those states basically just based on the fact that Azerbaijan is the successor state to the Soviet Union, therefore it's recognised to have those borders that that republic had as part of the USSR... And then recognition being a key sort of aspect of international law, it just really boils down to that, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. The position under international law is that Nagorno-Karabakh was given by Stalin to Azerbaijan as an autonomous area. It declared its independence from Azerbaijan in 1992 when it won a war for that independence, and it's been a democratic de facto republic ever since. And now the Azeris, claiming from Stalin, want to recapture it and either kill its people or make them flee.
And does that amount to genocide in effect? Is that a genocidal intent in terms of?
Well, genocide is difficult, but I think it's clearly a war crime, killing of civilians, ethnic cleansing, and is really a crime against humanity because it is human beings who are being killed. And at the moment, there was Russia brokered a certain peace agreement yesterday, and the attacks by the Azeris have continued. They broke the peace agreement, and they intend to continue until they capture the entire area. Mm. That's pretty clear, and they'll have Turkey's support, and it's terrible as these people are killed. And civilians, their schools and hospitals bombed, and nothing is being done. It does, of course, it's a time when attention is focused on the pandemic, and the world, Russia, has gone to water. It's not been prepared to take a strong line against Turkey and Azerbaijan, partly because of commercial links with oil and gas in Azerbaijan. And partly, of course, it rather likes the arrangement whereby its weapons are bought by Azerbaijan, and vast sums of money go to Russian coffers as a result. So for those reasons, it's a classic case of you have international law arguments, you want them tested, you have a crime, a war crime being committed, deliberate killing of civilians with the object of ethnic cleansing, and nothing is done.
Is this something Armenia could take to the International Court of Justice, Jeffrey?
It's already taken it to the European Court of Human Rights. It's obtained an order that the fighting should stop, which the Azeris simply ignored.
So what's the practical way to assert this right of self-determination? And
practical way is to bomb and strafe and kill the Azeris who are attacking. Mm. I'm afraid there is no other way at the moment, because the world has turned its back on this remarkable place, which is so beautiful. It's got a functioning court system, a functioning elected parliament and civil society. It's got free speech, which is something that Azerbaijan hasn't. I was watching a program last night about all the censorship in this authoritarian country, which will, of course, be imposed on Karabakh. They won't have free speech. They won't have the right to peacefully assemble, which they have at the moment. They'll lose all their democratic rights and be under a military government, I suspect.
It sort of makes you question whether international law is really law in a circumstance like this.
It's law, but it can't be enforced, would be my answer. There are times when realpolitik trumps international law and or keeps it in stasis or keeps it irrelevant to an actual conflict. And this is one case which exposes the weakness of international law. I mean, there is an order from the European Court of Human Rights which ought to be obeyed because Azerbaijan is a member. But when the blood is up and nationalism is rampant and victory is possible, then the Azeris simply ignore the law. There was a terrible case which I think really sums up the attitude, which was the Safarov case. I don't know whether you've heard of that. It was an appalling case where NATO was offering a course to members of the Armenian and Azeri armies. And one Azeri soldier, one day, finding himself next in the next bed with to an Armenian soldier, took an axe and chopped off his head. And of course, it was in Hungary, and he was sentenced to life imprisonment. And he served a few years, and then there was a deal done. Oil and gas was at the back of it, between the Hungarian and the Azeri government. And he was allowed to return to Baku to serve the rest of his sentence in an Azeri prison. Well, of course, the minute he landed, he was met by the president. He was elevated to, he was given an award and given a promotion. And of course, he never saw a moment of prison in Baku. And that just shows the level at which a government, for nationalistic reasons, when the blood is up and the power has shifted to your side, will ignore international law or even its own recent pledges and will go for the for victory and occupation, no matter how many civilians that will mean the death of.
Jeffrey, what, in your view, should Australia be doing? What can Australia be doing?
Well, Australia is an independent observer. Australia is committed to world peace. Australia is committed to human rights and to the International Criminal Court. So Australia should be, I think, supporting Armenia on to the extent that it should at the United Nations and even in public pronouncements express its grave concern at the invasion of Nagorno-Karabakh and urge that the Karabakh people should be entitled to their right to self-determination. That may be too much to ask. It may irritate Turkey. It will irritate Turkey and Azerbaijan. But it seems to me let me put it this way, most independent observers who've actually observed the situation in Nagorno-Karabakh in recent years have said, and I say too, there is an obvious solution. Keep Nagorno-Karabakh independent or make it a province of Armenia, which it is really, and return some of the buffer areas that were captured in the 1992 war to Azerbaijan. So that will be a gain for both sides. It will mean security for Nagorno-Karabakh and it will mean that Azerbaijan gets back some of the territory that it lost in the war. And it may mean that, I mean, at the moment, that territory is shared between Armenians and Azeris, who get on rather well, actually. Yeah. But the problem is that Azerbaijan won't buy that solution. It wants Nagorno-Karabakh, and it shouldn't have it historically or culturally. They have some remarkable, some unique carpets, for example, that are admired around the world. They have a they have the worst liqueur I've ever tasted, a mulberry liqueur that Armenians can't stand, and rightly so. But they do have all sorts of unique things that would be lost if the Azeris took and demolished Nagorno-Karabakh and all those wonderful Christian churches, several thousand of them, dating back to 340, I think, AD.
Jeffrey, if you could indulge us a little bit along, we want to shift topics a little bit here. We have our colleague, the great Felicity Graham, the Whig Felicity Graham, who's landed and has joined our conversation. Felicity, hello to you, if you can hear us.
Hello, Whigs. Hello, Jeffrey. Good to be with you.
Yeah. Fantastic. Jeffrey, Felicity has a very important question that relates to the Whigs and
sure.
That they've been working on right now. Felicity, please take it away.
Jeffrey, it's a bit off topic from what you've been discussing, but we really can't resist since we have you here. Yesterday, the Supreme Court of New South Wales issued a judgment effectively banning political protests until organisers can show that there is zero risk of transmission of COVID-19. Some of us find that proposition tantamount to a eulogy for democracy when still in this country, thousands of people are attending football games, people are free to participate in mass gatherings for a whole range of different social and economic purposes. Do you think Australia is suffering because of a lack of human rights standards? And what would you suggest could be done about how to remedy this impasse in terms of the constraint on political protest activity in this country?
Felicity, I said earlier that despite being an Australian and having the benefit of Magna Carta, I couldn't travel back to Australia. So I haven't been keeping up. I did read of one University of Sydney demonstration that was closed down by the cops, and I thought that was ridiculous when they were, it was a Black Lives Matter, I think, demonstration. But I would like to read the judgment before commenting on it, obviously, as any lawyer would. But it is a difficult balancing act, obviously, between public health, which sometimes requires everyone to conform if there is danger of a virus spreading, and the right to express yourself and the right to peaceful protest. And it's generally resolved by ignoring how it's resolved in America, which it isn't, because Trump rallies invariably feature people who aren't social distancing and aren't wearing masks. But in this context, I feel that if people, as a matter of conscience, feel that they can hazard participation in a demonstration, they should be entitled to do so, subject to undertakings by the organizers, which are enforced, that everyone will be wearing masks and that there will be a degree of social distancing. This is now quite common, even in Britain, where we've had to take very strict, in some areas, lockdowns and require everyone to participate, but that is not the case with demonstrations which are permitted to go ahead. So there is a compromise solution, I think, but I, as I say, I need to read the judgment to see what it said. I think there have been a number of cases where demonstrations have had to take court action to in order to go ahead.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Jeffrey, with your time. It's so kind of you to give it up a Sunday morning for you. I know you've complained about being in lockdown, but it really is an honour for myself and the Whigs, especially just to be graced with your presence at all.
Well, it's rather urgent. It's a case of people whom I knew, judges and lawyers too. I saw them all, who are at risk of being slaughtered by an aggressive, illegal attack.
Absolutely.
And the world isn't taking notice.
Well, thank you for drawing light to it. Our listeners really appreciate it. And I know myself and the Whigs really appreciate it. So thank you for your time. And look, if when COVID ends, please grace your fair home again so we can have you in the studio.
Can't wait.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Thanks, Jeffrey.
Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening. Please like The Whigs on Facebook at The Whigs Podcast. Don't forget to rate and review on iTunes.
Hey, it's Jim Minns here for the final time. I just want to remind you all that you can also follow us on Twitter at Whigs Podcast. And it is there that you can send us your questions and we'll answer them on the next episode.
This podcast was brought to you by Minimal Productions, produced by Jim Minns.